oil and blood and treasure that it will cost us to maintain this declaration. Still, the end was more than worth all the means. "You will see in a few days," he wrote in the second letter, "a declaration setting forth the causes which have impelled us to this mighty revolution, and the reasons that will justify it in the sight of God and man." That the hand of God was involved in the birth of the new nation, he had no doubt. "It is the will of heaven that the two countries should be sundered forever. If the people now were to have unbounded power, and as the people were quite as capable of corruption as the great, and thus high risks were involved, he would submit all his hopes and fears to an overruling providence, in which, unfashionable as the faith may be, I firmly believe." The bar of secrecy notwithstanding, the news spread rapidly throughout the city. "This day the Continental Congress declared the United Colonies free and independent states," recorded a young artist newly established in Philadelphia, Charles Wilson Peale, exuberant over the news. "The facts," wrote Elbridge Gerry, "were as well known in the taverns and coffee houses of the city as in Congress itself." But there could be no pause. There was too much still to be done. Congress had to review and approve the language of the drafted declaration before it could be made official. Deliberations of a different kind commenced at once, continuing through the next morning, July 3rd, when mercifully the temperature had dropped 10 degrees, broken by the storm of the previous day. For Thomas Jefferson, it became a painful ordeal, as change after change was called for, and approximately a quarter of what he had written was cut entirely. Seated beside Benjamin Franklin, the young Virginian looked on in silence. He is not known to have uttered a word in protest or in defense of what he had written. Later, he would describe the opposition to his draft as being like the ceaseless action of gravity weighing upon us night and day. At one point, Franklin leaned over to tell him a story that, as a printer and publisher over so many years, he must have offered before as comfort to a wounded author. He had once known a hatter who wished to have a sign made saying, "John Thompson, Hatter, makes and sells hats for ready money," this to be accompanied by a picture of a hat. But the man had chosen first to ask the opinion of friends, with the result that one word after another was removed as superfluous or redundant, until at last the sign was reduced to Thompson's name and the picture of the hat. Beyond its stirring preamble, most of the document before Congress was taken up with a list of grievances, specific charges against the king. "He has plundered our seas, ravaged our coasts, burnt our towns. He is at this time transporting large armies of foreign mercenaries to complete the works of death, desolation, and tyranny." And it was the king, the Christian king of Great Britain, Jefferson had emphasized, who was responsible for the horrors of the slave trade. As emphatic a passage as any, this on the slave trade was to have been the ringing climax of all the charges. Now it was removed in its entirety, because, said Jefferson later, South Carolina and Georgia objected. Some northern delegates, too, were a little tender on the subject, for though their people have very few slaves themselves, yet they had been pretty considerable carriers. In truth, black slavery had long since become an accepted part of life in all of the 13 colonies. Of a total population in the colonies of nearly 2,500,000 people in 1776, approximately 1 in 5 were slaves, some 500,000 men, women, and children. In Virginia alone, which had the most slaves by far, they numbered more than 200,000. There was no member of the Virginia delegation who did not own slaves, and of all members of Congress, at least a third owned or had owned slaves. The total of Thomas Jefferson's slaves in 1776, as near as can be determined from his personal records, was about 200, which was also the approximate number owned by George Washington. John Dickinson, who owned 11 African men and women, was understood to be Philadelphia's second-largest slaveholder. Even Benjamin Franklin, who adamantly opposed slavery, had once owned 2 black house servants, and had personally traded in slaves, buying and selling from his Market Street print shop. And though in recent years the Quakers of the city had been freeing more and more of their slaves, such notices as Franklin once published, offering a likely wench about 15 years old, were still to be seen in Philadelphia newspapers. One appearing that July in the Pennsylvania Journal read, "To be sold, a large quantity of pine boards that are well seasoned. Likewise, a Negro wench. She is to be disposed of for no fault, but only that she is present with child. She is about 20 years old and is fit for either town or country business." The President of Congress, John Hancock, had only in recent years freed the last of the slaves who were part of his lavish Boston household. And it was well known, as Jefferson said, that New Englanders had been considerable carriers in the lucrative slave trade. At one point, earlier in the century, approximately half the tonnage of New England shipping had been in transporting slaves, and the port of Boston prospered from the trade. But it was also New Englanders who had assailed slavery in the most vehement terms. As early as 1700, before Jefferson or anyone in Congress was born, Judge Samuel Sewall of Boston, an eminent Puritan known for his role as a judge in the Salem witch trials, had declared in a tract called The Selling of Joseph that all men, as they are sons of Adam, have equal right unto liberty, and saw no justification, moral or economic, for making property of human beings. Slavery was evil. Of the slave trade, he wrote, "How horrible is the uncleanness, immorality, if not murder, that the ships are guilty of that bring crowds of these miserable men and women." James Otis, in his famous speech on writs of assistance in 1761, had called for the immediate liberation of the slaves. "The colonists of Massachusetts are by the law of nature free-born, as indeed all men are, white and black. Does it follow that it is the right to enslave a man because he is black?" When Samuel Adams and his wife were presented with a black slave girl as a gift in 1765, they had immediately set her free. Of John Adams's circle in Philadelphia, the one to have taken the most assertive stand against slavery was the young physician Benjamin Rush, who from the time of the first Congress had been as close to all that went on as anyone not a delegate could have been, and who in another few weeks would himself be elected to Congress as one of the new Pennsylvania delegation. Rush, high-spirited, handsome, and all of 30, had studied medicine in Edinburgh and in London, where he came to know Benjamin Franklin, and once dined with Samuel Johnson and James Boswell. Overflowing with energy and goodwill, he was ardent for reform of all kinds. Smallpox inoculation for the poor, humane care for the insane, reform of the penal code, but especially for the abolition of slavery. In 1773, Rush had published a pamphlet attacking slavery, and in 1774, the year the first Congress convened, he had helped organize the Pennsylvania Society for Promoting the Abolition of Slavery. He had appealed to the clergy to recognize slavery as a sin, and urged all legislators, ye advocates for American liberty, to work for the liberty of blacks as well. The eyes of the world were watching, Rush charged. Yet he himself owned a slave. On first meeting, Adams and Rush had misjudged each other. Adams thought Rush a sprightly, pretty fellow, but too much a talker to be a deep thinker, while Rush found Adams cold and reserved. But they had quickly changed their minds, discovering much in common besides the love of talk. Like Adams, Rush was without affectation and unafraid to speak his mind, sometimes to the point of tactlessness. Prudence, he was fond of saying, is a rascally virtue. Like Jefferson, the young physician seemed to take limitless interest in nearly everything under the sun. Adams and Rush were of the same mind on slavery. Adams was utterly opposed to slavery and the slave trade, and, like Rush, favored a gradual emancipation of all slaves. That it was at the least inconsistent for slave owners to be espousing freedom and equality was not lost on Adams any more than on others on both sides of the Atlantic Ocean. In London, Samuel Johnson, who had no sympathy for the American cause, had asked, "How is it that we hear the loudest yelps for liberty from the drivers of Negroes?" Abigail, in her letters that spring, had questioned whether the passion for liberty could be equally strong in the breasts of those who have been accustomed to deprive their fellow creatures of theirs, and had earlier pondered whether the agonies of pestilence and war could be God's punishment for the sin of slavery. In time, Adams and Jefferson would each denounce slavery. Jefferson was to write of the degrading effects of the institution on both slave and master. Adams would call slavery a foul contagion in the human character. In years past, as an attorney, Adams had appeared in several slave cases for the owner, never the slave, but he had no use for slavery. He never owned a slave as a matter of principle, nor hired the slaves of others to work on his farm, as was sometimes done in New England. He was to declare unequivocally in later years that Negro slavery is an evil of colossal magnitude, and like Abigail, he felt this at the time. But neither he nor any other delegate in Congress would have let the issue jeopardize a Declaration of Independence, however strong their feelings. If Adams was disappointed or downcast over the removal of Jefferson's indictment of the slave trade, he seems to have said nothing at the time. Nor is it possible to know the extent of Jefferson's disappointment, or if the opposition of South Carolina and Georgia was truly as decisive as he later claimed. Very possibly there were other delegates, from North and South, happy to see the passage omitted, for the reason that it was so patently absurd to hold the king responsible for horrors that everyone knew Americans, and Christians no less than the king, had brought on themselves. Slavery and the slave trade were hardly the fault of George III, however ardently Jefferson wished to fix the blame on the distant monarch. Of more than 80 changes made in Jefferson's draft during the time Congress deliberated, most were minor and served to improve it. The king's conduct was called one of repeated rather than unremitting injuries. The accusation that the king had suffered the administration of justice totally to cease in some of these states was edited to a simpler, "He has obstructed the administration of justice." But one final cut toward the conclusion was as substantial nearly as the excise of the passage on the slave trade, and it appears to have wounded Jefferson deeply. To the long list of indictments against the king, He had added one assailing the English people, our British brethren, as a further oppressor, for allowing their parliament and their king to send over not only soldiers of our common blood, but Scotch and foreign mercenaries to invade and destroy us. And therein, Jefferson charged, was the heart of the tragedy, the feeling of betrayal, the common blood cause of American outrage. These facts have given the last stab to agonizing affection, and manly spirit bids us renounce forever these unfeeling brethren, he had written. We must endeavor to forget our former love for them. This most emotional passage of all was too much for many in Congress, and to it Jefferson had added a final poignant note. We might have been a free and great people together. Nearly all of this was removed. There was to be no mention of a last stab, or love, or of the free and great people that might have been. Nor was there to be any mention of Scottish mercenaries, James Wilson and John Witherspoon both being Scots. To no one's surprise, Adams did not sit silently by. He was present every hour, fighting fearlessly for every word, as Jefferson would write. No man better merited than Mr. John Adams to hold a most conspicuous place in the design. He was the pillar of its support on the floor of Congress, its ablest advocate and defender against the multifarious assaults encountered. Finally, to Jefferson's concluding line was added the phrase, "with a firm reliance on the protection of divine providence," an addition that Adams assuredly welcomed. Thus, it would read, "And for the support of this declaration, with a firm reliance on the protection of divine providence, we mutually pledge to each other our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor." But it was to be the eloquent lines of the second paragraph of the declaration that would stand down the years, affecting the human spirit as neither Jefferson nor anyone could have foreseen. And however much was owed to the writings of others, as Jefferson acknowledged, or to such editorial refinements as those contributed by Franklin or Adams, they were, when all was said and done, his lines. It was Jefferson who had written them for all time. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. In later years, the excessive summer heat of Philadelphia would frequently figure in accounts of Thursday, July 4th, 1776. In fact, the day, like the one before, was pleasantly cool and comfortable. In Congress, discussion of the Declaration appears to have continued through the morning until about 11 o'clock, when debate was closed and the vote taken. Again, as on July 2nd, 12 colonies voted in the affirmative, while New York abstained. Again, John Dickinson was absent. It all went very smoothly. Congress ordered that the document be authenticated and printed. But it would be another month before the engrossed copy was signed by the delegates. For now, only the President, John Hancock, and the Secretary of the Congress, Charles Thompson, fixed their signatures. With passage of the Declaration of Independence thus completed, and having thereby renounced allegiance to the King and proclaimed the birth of a new United States of America, the Congress proceeded directly to other business. Indeed, to all appearances, nothing happened in Congress on July 4th, 1776. Adams, who had responded with such depth of feeling to the events of July 2nd, recorded not a word of July 4th. Of Jefferson's day, it is known only that he took time off to shop for ladies' gloves and a new thermometer that he purchased at John Sparhawk's London bookshop for a handsome £3.15. But by the following morning, the 5th, printer John Dunlap had broadside editions available, and the delegates were busy sending copies to friends. On July 6th, the Pennsylvania Evening Post carried the full text on its first page. The great day of celebration came Monday, July 8th, at noon in the State House yard, where the Declaration was read aloud before an exuberant crowd. With drums pounding, 5 battalions paraded through the city, and on the common gave us the feu de joie, 13 cannon blasts, notwithstanding the scarcity of powder, as Adams recorded. Bells rang through the day and into the night. There were bonfires at street corners. Houses were illuminated with candles in their windows. In the Supreme Court room at the State House, as planned, a half-dozen Philadelphians chosen for the honor took the King's Arms down from the wall and carried it off to be thrown on top of a huge fire and consumed in an instant, the blaze lighting the scene for blocks around. "Fine starlight, pleasant evening," recorded Adams's friend Christopher Marshall. "There were bonfires, ringing bells, with other great demonstrations of joy upon the unanimity and agreement of the Declaration." Another Philadelphia patriot, Charles Biddle, a wealthy merchant who had joined the crowd in the State House yard to hear the Declaration read, recorded only that he had seen very few respectable people present. As mounted messengers carried the news beyond Philadelphia, celebrations broke out everywhere. In New York the next day, the Declaration was read aloud to Washington's assembled troops, and it was that night, at the foot of Broadway, that a roaring crowd pulled down the larger-than-life equestrian statue of George III. As in Philadelphia, drums rolled, bonfires burned, prayers were said, and toasts raised in town after town, north and south. When the news finally reached Savannah, Georgia, in August, it set off a day-long celebration, during which the Declaration was read 4 times in 4 different public places, and the largest crowd in the history of the province gathered for a mock burial of King George III. The feeling was that the air had been cleared at last. "The Declaration," said the Reverend Samuel Cooper of Boston, "must give new spring to all our affairs." The actual signing of the document would not take place until Friday, August 2nd, after a fair copy had been elegantly engrossed on a single giant sheet of parchment by Timothy Matlack, assistant to the Secretary of Congress. Nothing was reported of the historic event. As with everything transacted within Congress, secrecy prevailed. To judge by what was in the newspapers and the correspondence of the delegates, the signing never took place. In later years, Jefferson would entertain guests at Monticello with descriptions of black flies that so tormented the delegates, biting through their silk hose, that they had hurried the signing along as swiftly as possible. But at the time, Jefferson wrote nothing of the occasion, nor did John Adams. In old age, trying to reconstruct events of that crowded summer, both men would stubbornly and incorrectly insist that the signing took place July 4th. Apparently, there was no fuss or ceremony on August 2nd. The delegates simply came forward in turn and fixed their signatures. Also, a number of the most important figures in Congress were absent. Richard Henry Lee, George Wythe, Oliver Wolcott, Elbridge Gerry, and would sign later. A new representative from New Hampshire, Matthew Thornton, who had not been a member when the Declaration was passed, would add his name in November, and Thomas McKean of Delaware appears not to have signed until January 1777, which made him the last. Like the others, Adams and Jefferson each signed with his own delegation. Adams on the right, in a clear and firm, plain hand, Jefferson at lower center, with a signature more precise and elegant, but equally legible. The fact that a signed document now existed, as well as the names of the signatories, was kept secret for the time being, as all were acutely aware that by taking up the pen and writing their names, they had committed treason, a point of considerably greater immediacy now, with the British army so near at hand. Whether Benjamin Franklin quipped, "We must all hang together, or most assuredly we shall hang separately," is impossible to know. Just as there is no way to confirm the much-repeated story that the diminutive John Hancock wrote his name large so the king might read it without his spectacles. But the stories endured because they were in character. Like the remark attributed to Stephen Hopkins of Rhode Island. Hopkins, who suffered from palsy, is said to have observed on completing his spidery signature, "My hand trembles, but my heart does not." The most encouraging result of the decision for independence was its almost immediate effect on spirit within Congress and among the people, but also among the rank-and-file militia. "The Declaration of Independence has produced a new era in this part of America," wrote Benjamin Rush, who had since taken his place in Congress in time to be a signer. "The militia of Pennsylvania seems to be actuated with a spirit more than Roman. Near 2,000 citizens of Philadelphia have lately marched to New York." Such influence as the Declaration had had would have been inconceivable earlier. To Abigail, Adams wrote of the gallant spirit prevailing in these middle colonies, and described the militia turning out in great numbers and in high spirits. Samuel Adams, to whom the Declaration was the decisive measure, wished only that it had come sooner. Even those in Congress who had been so ardently opposed now, by word or deed, committed themselves to the glorious revolution. Robert Morris continued in his duties without pause, working as strenuously as anyone. "I think an individual that declines the service of his country because its counsels are not comfortable to his ideas makes a bad subject," he wrote, still unable to see himself as other than a subject. John Dickinson, though ill and exhausted from the strain of the past weeks, departed at the head of the first troops to march out of the city to join in the defense of New Jersey, a scene that made a deep impression on many, including John Adams. "Mr. Dickinson's alacrity and spirit," he told Abigail, "certainly becomes his character and sets a fine example." Section 2. The ships flying the Union Jack that arrived off New York at the end of June 1776, the fleet from Halifax that one eyewitness described as looking like all London afloat, had been only the start of an overwhelming show of British might come to settle the fate of the new United States of America. By July 3rd, 9,000 troops led by General William Howe had landed on Staten Island, where hundreds of Tories were on hand to welcome them. Howe himself had gone ashore on July 2nd, the very day that Congress had voted for independence. And in the days following, up the narrows between Staten Island and Long Island came ever more British sails, including an armada of 130 warships and transports from England under command of the General's brother, Admiral Richard Lord Howe. By mid-August, 32,000 fully equipped, highly trained, thoroughly professional British and German Hessian soldiers, more than the entire population of Philadelphia, were ashore on Staten Island, supported by 10 ships of the line and 20 frigates, making in all the largest, most costly British overseas deployment ever until that time. By contrast, the American Army gathered in defense of New York, digging in on Manhattan and Long Island, was optimistically thought to number 20,000 troops. These, nearly all poorly equipped amateurs led by Washington, who, in his year as commander-in-chief, had yet to fight a battle. From Long Island, one of Washington's ablest divisional commanders, Nathaniel Greene, wrote to tell John Adams that in reality the American force might number 9,000. And, as Adams knew, they had no naval support, not a single available warship or transport. When, on July 12th, with the wind and tide in their favor, the British sent two men of war up the Hudson River to demonstrate who had control, there was nothing to stop them. As the huge ships passed upstream, American militia stood gawking on shore, which evoked an angry general order from Washington declaring such unsoldierly conduct could only give the enemy a low opinion of the American army. From the flow of dispatches arriving at the War Office in Philadelphia, Adams was more aware of the situation than anyone in Congress, and he was miserable, thinking about the consequences of a defeat at New York. He had not wanted the responsibility of heading the Board of War, and felt vastly unequal to the multitude of problems and decisions to be grappled with. But it was also clear that they were all unequal to the task. No one in Congress was qualified. "We are all inexperienced in this business," he emphasized to Nathaniel Greene. The War Office consisted of rented space 2 blocks from the State House on Market Street. To a board of 5 members of Congress, Adams, Harrison, Rutledge, Sherman, and Wilson, fell the burden of virtually running the war. They were responsible for ordnance and fortifications, for appointing and promoting officers, for recruitment of enlisted men and raising rifle companies, for pay, provisions, and for somehow resolving the constant demand for flints, saltpeter and gunpowder, horses, wagons, tents, shoes, soap, and blankets. They dispatched ship carpenters where needed, appointed chaplains, and faced the incessant day-to-day frustrations of bickering, jealousies, and corruption. It was arduous, thankless work. "He must be very exactly and minutely acquainted with the state of every regiment," Adams was lectured by General Horatio Gates. "And as all decisions required the approval of Congress, it was for the board to prepare the reports on which to vote. It would be resolved that 5 tons of powder be sent to Williamsburg, or that British prisoners be moved from New Jersey to Pennsylvania, or that new positions of drum major and fife major be created, or that special commissioners be appointed to audit the accounts of the Army of New York." There were the ever-vexing complications of dealing in various colonial currencies of differing value, and the increasing worry over inflation and the fate of the new continental money, the unbacked paper currency being produced in Philadelphia in steadily greater quantity. One Nathan Sellers, a scrivener whose job it was to sign every bill by hand, recorded signing 4,800 bills in a single day that July. "If that," the continental currency, "suffers in its credit, the cause must suffer," Adams warned. "If that fails, the cause must fail." One of the committee assignments he shared with Jefferson was the Committee on Spies, charged with, among other things, drawing up a set of Articles of War, regulations and rules of discipline for the Army. Knowing discipline to be a difficult and unpopular subject, Adams had recommended that they present a complete system at once and let it meet its fate. And since, in his view, there was but one system of merit, that which had carried two empires to the head of mankind, the Roman and the British, the second being drawn directly from the first, he recommended a straight-on borrowing of the British Articles of War, with only a few modifications. According to Adams, writing years later, Jefferson in those days never failed to agree with me in everything of a political nature, and he very cordially concurred in this. But by midsummer, the matter of the Articles of War had been passed over to the Board of War and had still to be considered by Congress. Strongly opposed to the existing policy of short-term enlistments, Adams declared himself adamantly in favor of a regular army. But of his many worries, the greatest was disease. Responding to the medical theories of young Dr. Rush, he pleaded for greater cleanliness among the troops. Smallpox worried him most of all. Smallpox was the king of terrors, the enemy to be feared more than any other. "Smallpox! Smallpox! What shall we do with it?" he asked Abigail. In a dispatch of July 11th, Washington reported that an outbreak of smallpox in Boston had infected some of the troops and that every precaution was being taken to prevent the spread of infection to New York. Adams's labors on the Board of War began usually at 6 in the morning and continued until 9, then resumed again in the evening. Between times, he was in the thick of debate in Congress over the Articles of Confederation. He knew it to be work of the greatest importance, but the strain was beginning to take a toll. He needed rest and for the first time hinted to Abigail the possibility of a furlough. Then, on July 16th, came a letter from Abigail's uncle, Isaac Smith, reporting that Abigail, acting on her own, had decided that she and the children must be inoculated for smallpox. They had come to Boston to undergo the treatment, Smith himself having provided his large house on Court Street for their time of isolation. Adams was beside himself. "Never, never in my life had I so many cares upon my mind at once," he wrote to her. Under any other circumstances, he would leave for Boston at once. As it was, he had no choice. He could only pray for their health. "I cannot leave this place without more injury to the public now than I ever could at any other time, being in the midst of scenes of business which must not stop for anything." Her letter of explanation, written July 13th, did not reach Philadelphia for another week. Because of the outbreak of smallpox in Boston, thousands of people had come in from the surrounding countryside to be inoculated. It was there, in Boston, that smallpox inoculation had been introduced in America more than half a century earlier, and by a kinsman of Adams, Dr. Zabdiel Boylston, Adams's great uncle on his mother's side. The idea had come from a slave belonging to Cotton Mather, an African named Onesimus, who had said the practice was long established in Africa, where those with the courage to use it were made immune, and he had his own scar on his arm to show. The technique, the same as still practiced by Dr. Boylston, was to make a small incision, then with a quill scoop the pus from the ripe pustules of a smallpox patient into the open cut. A generally mild case of smallpox would result, yet the risk of death was relatively slight. The ordeal of the patient, however, could be considerable, as Adams knew from all he had seen at the time he was inoculated, and largely because of various purges that were thought essential to recovery. "Such a spirit of inoculation had never been known," Abigail reported. "The town and every house in it are as full as they can hold." She and the children were part of a family contingent numbering 17 that included the Cranches and their three children, Abigail's sister Elizabeth, A 3-year-old daughter of Brother William Smith named Louisa, whom Abigail had taken under her wing, 3 servants, and 2 cousins, Cotton Tufts, Jr., and John Thaxter, Jr., a former law clerk of Adams's who had lately become the tutor for the Adams children. "We had our bedding, etc., to bring," Abigail wrote. "A cow we have driven down from Braintree, and some hay I have had put into the stable, wood, etc., and we have really commenced housekeepers here. Our little one, 3-year-old Thomas, stood the operation manfully. I wish it was so you could have been with us, but I submit." "The little folks are very sick then and puke every morning, but after that they are comfortable," she continued. "Now, especially, he must keep writing to her. Every expression of tenderness is a cordial to my heart. Unimportant as they are to the rest of the world, to me, they are everything." Though she herself was well enough to turn out on July 18th for Boston's celebration of the Declaration of Independence, the children's ordeal went on. The stay in her uncle's house would last nearly 2 months. "Nabby has enough of the smallpox for all the family beside," Abigail would report. "She is pretty well covered. Not a spot of what is so sore that she can neither walk, sit, stand, or lay with any comfort." The pustules were the size of a large pea. Another time she would write of 6-year-old Charles burning with fever and going into a delirium that lasted 48 hours. In a letter to Isaac Smith, expressing his gratitude for all Smith was doing for his family, Adams said he would leave for Boston immediately if he could, but could not, in honor and duty to the public, stir from this place. We are in hourly expectation of some important event at New York. Writing to Abigail, he told her how proud he was of her for what she had done. He wished the whole populace could be inoculated. Yet he could not help being on tenterhooks. It had taken 10 days for her letter to reach him, and heaven only knew what might have transpired in the interval. It was the paradox of their lives that, as much as his public role kept them apart, he always needed to be with Abigail and she with him. They would never become accustomed to being separated. "I can do nothing without you," he was to tell her one way or another, time and again, and always from the heart. She would have him no other way than he was. She believed fervently in what he was doing, encouraged him in the role, and wished no other for him. She wanted him to be where he was doing his utmost for the country. And still, she desperately wanted him with her. Each worried incessantly about the other's health and well-being, at times to the point of making themselves ill. With sickness all about her now, Abigail sensed from John's letters that something was amiss with him. "Not one word respecting yourself," she wrote. "My anxiety for your welfare will never leave me but with my parting breath. 'Tis of more importance to me than all this world contains besides." Her suspicions were justified. By late July, it had been 6 months since he and Joseph Bass had set off in the snow from Braintree, and the effect of the work and unrelieved pressure, of too little sleep, no exercise, and increasing worries over her, had caught up with him. In fact, the whole Massachusetts delegation was in a bad way. Elbridge Gerry, sick and exhausted, had already departed for home. John Hancock was beset by gout. Robert Treat Paine, racked by a cough, seldom appeared in Congress. Samuel Adams was completely worn out. On July 25th, having received no further news from Boston, Adams addressed a letter to the General Court of Massachusetts requesting a leave of absence, and to James Warren, who as Speaker of the General Court could help arrange such a leave, he declared, My face is grown pale, my eyes weak and inflamed, my nerves tremulous, my mind as weak as water. He suffered feverous heats by day and sweats by night, an infallible symptom, he was sure, of an approaching collapse. I know better than anybody what my constitution will bear and what it will not, he told Warren, and you may depend upon it I have already tempted it beyond prudence and safety. Philadelphia's customary steamy summer had returned in force. On a particularly sweltering Sunday, July 28th, during which he appears never to have left his Market Street lodgings, Thomas Jefferson checked his thermometer no less than 14 times, dutifully recording every reading from a low of 76 3/4 at 6:20 in the morning to a high of 85 by mid-afternoon. At 10 that night, it was still 79 1/4. Jefferson, too, was desperate to be gone. He was concerned about his wife, and like many in Congress, he continued to believe the war would be of short duration. The following day, he wrote to Richard Henry Lee, who had been absent since mid-June, pleading for Lee to return and relieve him. "For God's sake, for your country's sake, and for my sake, come," he implored. "I receive by every post such accounts of the state of Mrs. Jefferson's health that it will be impossible for me to disappoint her expectation of seeing me at the time promised." Jefferson hoped to be home by mid-August, and had no intention of returning to Congress. The nature of his wife's ailment, however, was never explained. What expressions of worry or affection or frustration, what details of his own health he confided in the privacy of his letters to Martha Jefferson, or she to him, were not to be known, as he would one day, for reasons he never expressed, burn all their correspondence. Earlier that spring, in Virginia, Jefferson had himself suffered a severe breakdown following the sudden death of his mother. Excruciating headaches had kept him bedridden for weeks. Jefferson's feelings for his mother are difficult to gauge. He is not known to have ever expressed affection for her, and of her death he wrote all of one sentence, notable for its brevity and absence of the least sentiment. "My mother died at 8 o'clock this morning in the 57th year of her age," was all he chose to record. Possibly it was a deeply private love for his mother, and the shock of her death coming so suddenly that explained his collapse. Or possibly it was worry over his wife's illness, or the stress of revolutionary politics. But there was no mistaking the intensity of his suffering. It had been necessary to delay his return to Congress for nearly 6 weeks. Now, to his friend John Page, Jefferson wrote that it was only with great pain that he remained in Philadelphia. While the Board of War consumed much of Adams's time and energy, he was nonetheless in the thick of discussion and debate over the most pressing issue before Congress, the proposed Articles of Confederation and Perpetual Union. With independence proclaimed, Confederation, a working union of the colonies, had become the focus of spirit animating the delegates. Union was as essential as independence, nearly all contended, indeed more important in the view of many, and the issues to be resolved were formidable. Strict secrecy prevailed, much to Adams's disapproval. There was theory and there was practice in government, and Adams, the delegate who, as Rush said, could see the whole subject at a glance, was determined that with theory now so eloquently proclaimed, practice be attended with equal diligence, and he wanted nothing about the deliberations to be concealed. In Massachusetts, the idea of galleries for the public to watch the legislature was the custom. When Wilson of Pennsylvania, who agreed with him, moved that the doors be opened, galleries erected, or that Congress adjourn to some public building where the people might be accommodated, Adams enthusiastically seconded the motion, but to no avail. As things were, Congress had no real legal authority. It could only pass resolutions, not laws. Having thus far dealt primarily with the minutiae of a plan for Confederation, the delegates by late July had gotten down to the great points of representation, boundaries, and taxation, in Jefferson's words. And as Josiah Bartlett wrote with New Hampshire understatement, the sentiments of the members were very different on many of the articles. Nor was progress ever easy. "I find," wrote Rush, who had been in Congress all of a few weeks, "there is a great deal of difference between sporting a sentiment in a letter or over a glass of wine upon politics and discharging properly the duties of a senator." To Adams, as he explained to Abigail, there were two especially knotty problems. If a confederation should take place, one great question is how shall we vote? Whether each colony shall count one? Or whether each shall have a weight in proportion to its numbers, or wealth, or exports or imports, or a compound ratio of all? Another is whether Congress shall have authority to limit the dimensions of each colony, to prevent those which claim by charter or proclamation or commission to the South Sea, the Pacific Ocean, from growing too great and powerful, so as to be dangerous to the rest. More than that, he felt he could not tell her. And for 3 days, July 30th, 31st, and August 1st, Adams was engaged in passionate debate over the first of these problems. As it stood, according to Article 17 of the proposed plan, each colony, irrespective of population or wealth, was to have one vote in deciding all questions concerning the Confederation. 13 separate states would have 13 equal votes, a concept Adams strongly opposed. He advocated voting in proportion to population, which was not surprising for someone from Massachusetts, one of the most populated and wealthy states. But he spoke more as an American than a New Englander. The individuality of the colonies was a mere sound, he said, according to Jefferson's notes. The Confederacy is to make us one individual only. It is to form us, like separate parcels of metal, into one common mass. We shall no longer retain our separate individuality, but become a single individual as to all questions submitted to the Confederacy. Speaking for the small colonies, Hopkins of Rhode Island pointed out that the four largest would contain more than half the inhabitants of the Confederacy and would thus govern the others as they pleased. But Benjamin Rush, in an eloquent first speech in Congress, declared, "The more a man aims at serving America, the more he serves his colony." We have been too free with the word independence. We are dependent on each other, not totally independent states. When I entered that door, I considered myself a citizen of America. With Franklin and Wilson, Rush moved that the vote be in proportion to numbers, insisting further that only freemen should be counted and that this would have the excellent effect of inducing the colonies to discourage slavery. Jefferson was among those who remained silent, and the issue was not to be resolved then or for a long time to come. But on the second knotty problem, that concerning Virginia's claim that her boundaries extended to the South Sea, which was debated August 2nd, the same day as the signing of the Declaration of Independence, Jefferson did speak up to say he protested the right of Congress to decide upon the right of Virginia. The tension grew extreme. John wrote to Abigail of being in constant suspense, uncertainty, and anxiety about the army of New York, and about my best, dearest, worthiest, wisest friend in this world and all my children. Even if he were granted a leave of absence, it would not come soon. Things being what they were, perhaps it would be better if she came to Philadelphia. If she were beside him, Adams wrote, he could stay on indefinitely, proud and happy as a bridegroom. But thinking better of it, he decided she should inquire about horses to bring him home. If Bass is in the land of the living and is willing to take one more ride with his old friend, let him come. Low in spirits, feeling misjudged and unappreciated by others in Congress, some of whom he was sure mistook his ardor for ambition, he succumbed to brooding and self-pity. Nobody understood him. "I have a very tender, feeling heart," he wrote. "This country knows not and never can know the torments I have endured for its sake." He would rather build stone walls upon Penn's Hill than hold the highest office in government, he told her, as though he believed every word. His view of the prospects at New York grew steadily darker. "May heaven grant us victory if we deserve it," he prayed. "If not, patience, humility, and persistence under defeat." But sensitive to Abigail's own anxiety in the long days of her confinement in Boston, he began writing at greater length and more frequently than he had, filling pages with his thoughts on a great variety of subjects, conscious that the mixture was often quite odd. Her pleasure in such letters was boundless. "I know not how you find the time amidst such a multitude of cares as surround you," she wrote. "I am really astonished at looking over the number of letters I have received during this month. I hope 'tis your amusement and relaxation from care to be thus employed. It has been a feast to me." A large wall map at the State House inspired a letter given over entirely to geography. The map of the British Empire in America, with the French and Spanish settlements adjacent thereto, by Henry Popple, measured nearly 8 feet by 8 feet, and was so detailed it even marked Braintree, spelled B-A-N-T-R-Y. As a branch of knowledge, geography was absolutely necessary to every person of public character, and to every child, Adams declared. "Really, there ought not to be a state, a city, a promontory, a river, a harbor, an inlet, or a mountain in all America, but what should be intimately known to every youth who has any pretensions to liberal education." A sermon preached one Sunday by an unknown Southern Baptist minister led to an extended essay on New England and Southern preachers, the benefits of travel and education, Adams's own ambition to establish a Boston Philosophical Society, and concluded with a consideration of the shortcomings of his fellow New Englanders, in which he was also writing about himself. "My countrymen want art and address. They want knowledge of the world. They want the exterior and superficial accomplishments of gentlemen, upon which the world has foolishly set so high a value. In solid abilities and real virtues, they vastly excel in general any people upon this continent. Our New England people are awkward and bashful, yet they are pert, ostentatious, and vain, a mixture which excites ridicule and gives disgust. They have not the faculty of showing themselves to best advantage, nor the art of concealment of this faculty, an art and faculty which some people possess in the highest degree. Our deficiencies in these respects are owing wholly to the little intercourse we have had with strangers, and to our inexperience in the world. These imperfections must be remedied, for New England must produce the heroes, the statesmen, the philosophers, or America will be no great figure for some time. He wrote of Benjamin Rush as the very model of a member of the American Philosophical Society, and described a rare moment away from the cares of Congress, a visit he had made to the studio of Charles Wilson Peale on Arch Street, where he had had the pleasure of seeing portraits by Peale of Washington, Franklin, the young wife of Benjamin Rush, and various members of Peale's large family. Peale, a new star in the Philadelphia firmament, young, gifted, gregarious, was also a wholehearted patriot, who only days earlier had signed on as a common soldier in a company of local militia. "He is ingenious," Adams wrote. "He has vanity, loves finery, wears a sword, gold lace, speaks French, is capable of friendship, and strong family attachments and natural affections." Adams was drawn particularly to a painting Peale had begun several years earlier following the death of a daughter who, like Adams's own Susanna, had died in infancy. "He showed me one moving picture. His wife, all bathed in tears, with a child about 6 months old laid out upon her lap. This picture struck me prodigiously." Encouraged by Adams's interest, Peale brought out books for him to see, showed him his sketches of Virginia plantation houses where he had stayed, including Washington's Mount Vernon. "He showed me several imitations of heads which he had made in clay as large as life with his hands only. Among the rest, one of his own head and face, which was a very great likeness." Adams was delighted. How he wished he had the time and tranquility of mind for these elegant and ingenious arts of painting, sculpture, statuary, architecture, and music. But if Peale's portraits were all very well done, he told Abigail, they were not so accomplished as those by John Singleton Copley, a view he knew would please her, since two particularly fine examples of Copley's work, companion portraits of Isaac Smith and his wife Elizabeth, hung in the house where she was confined. "Copley," Adams assured her, "is the greatest master that ever was in America." Writing of her days in the Smith house, Abigail told him she had discovered the joy of a room of her own. She had never coveted anything until now. It was a small room of her aunt's with a pretty desk, bookshelves, and a window overlooking a garden. She wrote all her letters there, she explained, and kept his letters to her unmolested by anyone. "Here, I say, I have amused myself in reading and thinking of my absent friend, sometimes with a mixture of pain, sometimes with pleasure, sometimes anticipating a joyful and happy meeting, whilst my heart would bound and palpitate with the pleasing idea and with the purest affection I have held you to my bosom till my whole soul has dissolved in tenderness and my pen fallen from my hand. How often do I reflect with pleasure that I hold in possession a heart equally warm with my own, and fully as susceptible of the tenderest impressions, and who even now, whilst he is reading here, feels all I describe. I must leave my pen to recover myself and write in another strain," she went on. "I wish for peace and tranquility. All my desires and all my ambition is to be esteemed and loved by my partner, to join with him in the education and instruction of our little ones, to set under our own vines in peace, liberty, and safety." Then, almost as an afterthought, she said there was an odd report circulating in Braintree that he had been poisoned. Early on Thursday, August 22nd, an exceptionally clear, bright day in New York, the British commenced their invasion of Long Island. In wave after wave, first in small boats, then transports, 15,000 English, Scottish, and Hessian troops were rowed across the Narrows from Staten Island to land without opposition on the broad shoreline near Gravesend, 8 miles to the rear of the American stronghold on Brooklyn Heights. A violent storm the night before had cleared the air. The wind was out of the north. Everything sparkled in sunlight. An aide to Admiral Richard Lord Howe described the spectacle of a fleet of above 300 ships and vessels with their sails open to dry, the sun shining clear upon them, of the green wooded hills and meadows of Long Island, and the calm surface of the water as one of the finest and most picturesque scenes that imagination can fancy. And to this was added the vast importance of the business and of the motions of the day. Contrary to basic military doctrine, Washington had divided his forces between Manhattan and Long Island. Expecting a second, larger British landing on Manhattan, he remained there, while on Long Island his battalions braced themselves for the assault. But for days, the British command under General William Howe made no move in force. Not until August 27th, when a furious battle was fought to the southwest of Brooklyn Heights. Washington was by then on the scene with reinforcements from Manhattan. Exhorting his men to conduct themselves like soldiers, he told them everything